Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. President Donald Trump has declared the spread and fight against coronavirus a national emergency. This comes after Governor Tom Wolf made a state emergency declaration late last week. Coronavirus is being called the most serious health threat the U.S. has faced in possibly the last 100 years. Smart Talk will focus on COVID-19 or the coronavirus throughout the week, and that includes important information as well as updates. COVID-19 or coronavirus is most dangerous for older people so far. The majority of people who have died have been over the age of 70. Many people that age or older live in skilled nursing facilities, personal care homes, or assisted living residences. As a result, precautions and plans have been implemented at these facilities to keep residents safe and from contracting the virus. The Pennsylvania Healthcare Association advocates for nonprofit and for-profit facilities. Joining us from the first portion of today's program is Zach Schamberg, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Healthcare Association. Zach Schamberg, welcome to the program.
Scott, thanks for having me, although I certainly wish the circumstances were different for this
visit. Absolutely, absolutely. And we, along the way in the past, we've talked about having you on the program to talk about assisted care and nursing care, but here we are today with this.
So that's right.
We'll do it in the future. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And coming up a little bit later in the program, we'll be talking about disaster response, and also have a pediatric infectious disease specialist on the program as well. All right, so the big question is, what have Pennsylvania nursing facilities, personal care homes, and assisted living facilities done so far?
Yeah, so Scott, I can talk about that. And first, I want to really focus on Washington State, because one of the luxuries that Pennsylvania providers have had is using Washington State and what's happened there in their nursing homes as a learning experience here. So what Washington State has taught us, and we've kept the lines of communication very open throughout the last few weeks, the most important things that providers can do is deep clean, high touch surfaces, right? We're in flu season anyway, so we should be cleaning. We need to educate or re-educate all staff on the use of PPE or personal protective equipment. That's masks, gowns, gloves, goggles. I think the most important step that providers can take, and they've already taken, and we've seen CMS now come out in support of this, as well as the governor and the Department of Health, is crafting a visitation policy and basically restricting as best you can any visitors, ancillary providers, anybody from coming into the facility. Because at this point, the best way to prevent COVID-19 from spreading in a facility, I think, is to keep it out in the first place.
What went wrong in Washington?
That's a good question. I think, well, we know now that that was spread in the community and it was brought into a nursing home. And I don't know that you can say things went wrong, but I think that you can say that this was the first we had dealt with it in long-term care. It was the first time we had seen it in the United States. And frankly, I just don't think they were prepared for it. And again, other states now have had the luxury to learn from what's happening in Washington State, and we've been able to take guidance from that.
You said that the lines of communication have been open. Do you mean with Washington State,
yes,
your counterparts in Washington?
So we have had calls with our counterparts in Washington State. Last night, I had a call with every one of my counterparts in all 50 states, including our national organization, the American Healthcare Association. And basically, it's all information sharing. It's up to the minute what's going on in other states. What do we need to be ready for in Pennsylvania? And that has been an incredibly beneficial resource for us.
In what way? What did you learn?
So I'm learning, or we're learning, basically how to combat COVID-19, how other states are handling things like staffing challenges, because that's something that, especially with schools closing, is going to be a real problem for healthcare facilities, not just long-term care. We're learning about the supply of PPE or the personal protective equipment, and that's a real issue both in Pennsylvania and nationwide. And basically, we're just taking cues from other states on what has happened there and what do we need to be ready for. Because Scott, there are no reported cases of COVID-19 in long-term care facilities in Pennsylvania yet, but that doesn't mean that it won't happen here.
Staffing is always an issue in long-term care because, let's face it, a lot of the facilities, the pay isn't very high, and sometimes there's some places have high turnover.
Sure.
But I can see that being especially an issue right now.
Yeah, and again, with schools closing, now you're going to have employees who are going to need to stay home. We have instructed all providers that if you have an employee who's not feeling well, who's sneezing, coughing, has the sniffles, they should stay home as well. So we are going to potentially lose a great number of workers, of direct care staff, of anyone in a long-term care facility. So you're right. The workforce issues and shortages that already existed are now being compounded by the COVID-19 outbreak. And, you know, last week we teamed up with Leading Age PA, which is basically another association, our counterparts in Pennsylvania, to ask the governor for relief on some of the staffing regulations and requirements. Basically, again, what we've learned in other states tells us we need to be ready to handle staffing shortages here.
So visitation, this is kind of a double-edged sword. I mentioned to you that I saw someone mention on social media that the mental health that my father, mother, friend that I want to visit in a long-term facility, they could be sad. They could be depressed because they're not getting any visitors. You were just telling me about your own father, his birthday. So, you know, that is an aspect of that. But weigh against what could happen. I guess that's what has to happen.
Yeah, and it's actually my grandfather. My father.
Oh, I'm sorry.
My father is not yet in a nursing home. Maybe one day soon. But it's my grandfather, actually. And I can speak to you not as just an advocate, but as the family member of a loved one in a long-term care facility. Today is my grandfather's birthday. He has dementia. He's in a facility in southeast Pennsylvania. And, you know, we're finding other ways to be there for him, be it Skype, FaceTime, phone calls, because at the end of the day, we understand that this is in the best interest of his health and the health of the staff there, the health of the other residents there. And it's heartbreaking to not see him and not be able to be there for him in person. But again, to your point, I think the health and safety of the residents and staff has to take precedence at this time.
Does your grandfather understand? You mentioned that he suffers from dementia.
Does he understand if we talk to him over the phone or
why you're not visiting?
No. And that's really the toughest part of this. But again, I have to put his health and safety above that at this time. And I'm hoping that you know, in a couple weeks or a couple months that we'll be able to go in and see him.
Yeah. And I ask about your grandfather in particular, but the question could go for the thousands who are in long-term facilities right now that it has to be, I mean, for many people, it's lonely to begin with. Yes, you make some friends there. You have staff to be friendly with. But when you're not seeing family members, that can be particularly bad.
Yeah, and we're just encouraging all providers to make sure they keep the lines of communication open between the family members and the residents of a facility. And I think that's most important, to let them know what's going on, to let them know that their loved one is still being cared for, is still receiving that care. I think in this time, that's the most beneficial thing a provider can do.
Inside the long-term facilities, physically, does it look any different? I mean staff, mask.
Well, so you see staff with masks. Certainly there's a lot less activity. CMS on Saturday.
CMS is
the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
All right.
They advise that all communal dining, all communal activities be canceled. So certainly you don't get that the activity or the community that you would otherwise. So it's tough to see right now. But again, it's in the best interest of the residents and the staff and their health. you know, again, you do see staff walking around with masks. It's almost kind of eerie, but it's what has to be done.
Mm. Any differences in diets or anything like that?
Other than the community dining being canceled, so you don't have that, again, sense of community with residents dining together in a cafeteria or a dining hall.
Oh, that's not happening?
So for the most part, we are advising that to not happen. So we want to try our best to do meals in rooms, small gatherings. I mean, CMS, I think it was CMS came out yesterday, or the CDC said, we don't want gatherings of 50 people or more across the country.
Oh, CDC,
so that's,
yeah.
That certainly applies to long-term care providers.
Mm. What about vendors? Because obviously there have to be those who deliver medication,
sure,
food, other supplies that you use. What about those vendors?
So think about this, and this was brought up to me this weekend. What happens if a provider needs to call 911 and EMS services come to the facility? What do they have to do? Do they need to be screened? So what we're advising providers to do is, if there are ancillary providers coming in, therapists, anybody, that they do need to be screened at the door. Their temperatures need to be taken. They need to wash their hands. And we're relying on our partner providers. Basically, if let's say you're an EMS, that someone needs to check that morning when you come to work, or that night when you come to work, that you don't have a temperature, that you're not exhibiting any symptoms, so that we can get you in and out of the facility as soon as possible.
Are there more physician visits? Because most facilities don't have a physician on staff all the time. They're registered nurses, but not doctors. And a doctor will visit patients throughout the week. What about now? Are there more visits, more residents being seen more often by physicians?
Yeah, I don't know about more visits, Scott. I don't know that I can speak to that, but I will say that the continuity of care is continuing in facilities. So anything that a resident would have needed before, they're still getting.
Mm. What about emergency and contingency plans for each individual home?
In terms of...
Have they been updated? Are they staff aware of what's going on?
So, you know, I hate to compare COVID-19 to the flu, because it's obviously, it's more deadly, especially for our vulnerable population. But there were infection control protocols put in place already for flu season. So most facilities have had to kind of alter that guidance, but that plan has already been in place and facilities are following it. Not much would have really changed in the face of COVID-19. So there's still those protocols and plans in place already.
Zach Schamberg, I want to thank you very much for being on with us today. If you had any advice, parting information for our audience who may have a relative, loved one, friend that is in long-term care, what would it be?
I would say two things. One is keep the lines of communication open with the staff at the facility where your loved one resides. Make sure that you can talk to your loved one. Make sure that you can communicate and know that they're getting the care they deserve. And two, thank the workers in those facilities. This is an extraordinary time, and these people, Scott, truly are heroes.
Mm. Zach Schamberg is the president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Healthcare Association. Thank you very much for being with
us. Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. This week on Smart Talk, we are focusing on COVID-19 or the coronavirus. We will have a lot of segments this week looking at a lot of different areas related to coronavirus. So stay tuned. And any questions that you may have, we've been compiling questions from you, the listener, or those who have questions about coronavirus. We know it can be confusing. If you want to make it easy for yourself to make decisions during this challenging time, you can find answers to common questions or ask your own question at WITF.org/coronavirus. An excellent resource. A lot of questions have come in from listeners, and we do our best to try to get those questions answered. The U.S. response to the coronavirus has lagged other nations that have contained it well, like South Korea, for example. So what is going right and what was done so well or not so well. Dr. Eric Martin is an associate professor of management at Bucknell University and has studied and written about disaster responses. Dr. Martin, welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thank you for having me, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And coming up a little bit later in the program, we will have an infectious disease specialist on the program as well. So, Dr. Martin, here's the big question. Your thoughts on how the U.S. has responded to the coronavirus?
Well, I think it's unfolding, of course. Originally it was slow, as you mentioned, and I think more could have been done more quickly, but it's very difficult in a sort of slow crisis like this, right? It's not in a very immediate thing, such as the 9/11 attacks or something that would rally all stakeholders at once to respond to something. And here we've seen people sort of slowly getting on board, almost incrementally. Maybe we're at a tipping point right about now where things are starting to align and we're starting to see agreement at multiple levels of government and different types of decision makers.
You said that a couple of things that have stuck out, that this has been a slow process, not like an event like 9/11 or, if we go back in history, an assassination or something that the nation pulled together. What makes this different in that way? Why would you call it slow, a slow event?
I think my work is from an organizational perspective, and so organizations tend to respond to their various stakeholders that are all around them. And when those stakeholders are responding with various degrees of risk tolerance to various understandings of their stakeholders and their constituents, there's not immediate alignment. So it makes people, the fear of embarrassment from coming out first and making a big move constrains decision making in a lot of ways, as opposed to having something said from the top and it comes down and everyone speaks in one single voice. That's very helpful in times like this.
Specifically and bluntly, would you say that what we've heard from the White House so far and President Trump was part of the reason for that?
Well, the tone is changing right now. We're seeing the tone change, and I think there's a much more serious tone. But yeah, there's some skepticism, which allows people to question to the extent that this is a crisis, right? We talk in management about there's simple problems where we agree on the problem and the solution. There's complex problems where we disagree on either the problem or the solution. And then there's wicked problems, which are problems that we disagree on both the problem and the solution. For some time now, I think there's been disagreement about both the problem and the solution. Now I think people are starting to recognize for sure this is an issue, we need to address it, and now we can go back to normal problem solving, which is how do we address this, right? But that idea that some people were questioning, again, your last guest alluded to the fact of not confusing this with the flu. But that's been a common refrain where we've seen, what are those numbers and why do I need to react so quickly to this particular issue? People get on board at different stages, and that disrupts the decision-making chain and disrupts single, clear disaster communication, which is critical in times like this. Mm.
But yet the Centers for Disease Control, for example, and a lot of other organizations have contingency plans, have emergency plans in place. When we're talking about the CDC, I mean, this is the Centers for Disease Control for the United States.
Right.
Why confusion? Why not follow that right off the bat?
Yeah, I can't answer that. I think there's a lot of things about disasters. There's acute issues, what happens, and then there's that chronic sort of underlying problems. To be honest, I think some of the skepticism of news, some of the divisiveness in our country have allowed folks to politicize some of those moments instead of really getting behind an expert like the CDC, right?
So you just used two terms. You said chronic and acute. Mm. Now, many people think of that in relationship to an illness, but you're using those terms in another way. What do you mean by chronic and acute?
So this came out explicitly in my work in Haiti, where there were long-term chronic underlying problems like governance, like authority and power and decision-making and capacity of institutions. And those are the chronic things that sort of underlie all responses. Then there's the acute disaster, right? Something just happens at that very moment. And that tends to expose those underlying chronic issues. So in what you were just asking me here, you know, here's the acute issue. The acute issue is an immediate spread of a disease and the possibility of death and great problems. One chronic issue might be that we haven't all been aligned on what are valuable and reliable sources of information, and the fact that some folks were not listening to the CDC very early on with their dire warnings, or the WHO for that matter, right? So,
You know, I'm thinking about some of the events, the disasters that we have had in the past. Going back to Hurricane Katrina, for example, in New Orleans and the southeastern part of the United States, that kind of followed a pattern of what we do here in the United States with a natural disaster, or in this case, a health emergency, is okay, the state government is the first. The state and local governments are the first to respond, making a statewide, as Governor Wolf did here in Pennsylvania, statewide emergency declaration. And then FEMA, if it is devastating enough where there is that much damage or health is jeopardized, the FEMA gets involved, the federal government. So in this case, you know, one of the things that we're hearing is, and the president himself actually said this, is that, and this was, I think, in relationship to testing, is that the United States is really not set up well to deal with an emergency like this. That states are taking the lead. That would seem to be a problem.
It sure is. Yeah, absolutely. Especially because of the possibility of interstate spread of this kind of thing, right? That is a big issue. And I think, again, the lack of this moment in time that sort of aligns everyone to look for that leadership, let alone whether the leadership's there or not, to crave it, to ask for it. Instead, we're seeing slow rollouts, and I think that it exposes those decision makers to extraordinary political risk. You know, I'm thinking of the governor, is it Pritzker in Illinois?
Yes, yes.
Just coming out now, and these folks, I was watching the Sunday news like everyone else, right? These folks are coming out questioning whether they should shut down bars and restaurants and what we should do, and then just moments later, hours after that, he goes out in the lead and makes that very painful decision. I mean, there's going to be a lot of folks that are hurting from that, but it's all on him, right? And so now he sort of hopes that other players, other governors are jumping on board, which will help legitimize his decision. But I just feel badly about that. I wish there was sort of a top-down sort of communication where people could align to that and it can protect them to make those difficult decisions.
And from what I understand about Illinois is that, I saw a video of Governor Pritzker, and he was upset because he was telling people to voluntarily think about it and voluntarily stay home and not have their normal lifestyle on Friday. Yeah. And a lot of people didn't listen. And, with St. Patrick's Day coming up Tuesday, a lot of people decided to go to bars and restaurants. And so that's why he took this step.
Right.
As you said earlier, it seems like we have reached a tipping point now where maybe the public does understand.
Yeah. And that comes down to a personal level, and we're having this conversation with all of our parents, parents of my children and of my kids' friends, questioning how serious do we need to take it. So, yes, we don't have school. Yes, we're staying at home. But can our kids see anyone? What is that tolerance there? And it's very difficult absent you know, some centralized voice where we're hearing that in a repeated, consistent message. And instead, I feel like we're hearing different kinds of messaging.
I mentioned South Korea in my introduction. Italy is at the opposite end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
What did, from your observations, what did South Korea do right? And then I'll ask about what Italy didn't, things didn't go so well.
Right. Well, I'm not 100% certain. You know, I've just read some of the news. Part of it is going to be a cultural thing, right? And it's a cultural thing about your understanding of identity and community. And I think that is important to recognize. You know, what responsibilities do you have towards which communities? My colleague here, Neil Boyd, a professor also in the College of Management here, he does work on sense of community responsibility, right? And there's this notion of to what extent am I associated with a community, and then at what point do I feel like I have a responsibility towards that community? I think we'd probably guess, based culturally on South Korea, that they have a more collective understanding of community than perhaps we do. And here, again, back to that stakeholder notion, I have a community at work, I have a community in my town, I have a community of my children's friends, and those are all sort of slightly different, and people are going to engage with those communities and feel a responsibility towards those communities in different ways, as opposed to aligning them all very quickly.
You know, it's funny you bring up culture. I, again, saw a social media post over the weekend of a woman who said, I'm out at, and she named the restaurant, having a few beers, having dinner, and I'm not going to change the way I live. I live in the United States where I'm free to do what I want.
Right.
That's a cultural point of view.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And it changes based on folks' risk tolerance. You know, again, in our family, we've thought about, okay, what are the steps we need to take? All right, people shouldn't come into our house, and we should, you know, protect, you know, do some sanitizing and some hygiene issues. And then my son's friends knock on the door, and of course they walk right in, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And my wife and I both looked at each other, and it just seemed too extraordinary, right, to jump out of your chair and say, get out of here, you're not going to do that. On the other hand, we both looked at each other and said, we need to have this conversation, boys. You know, folks can wait outside. And then the next step is, do you even associate at all? And again, we're not hearing that advice. We're not in a quarantine yet. You know, so that's what makes it difficult. And then, per your point of our freedoms, everyone's allowed to make those choices based on their own decision-making. So.
You're a professor of management, and
yes,
I imagine that's in the School of Business.
College of Management.
Okay.
Yes.
What's the difference between management and leadership?
Well, leadership tends to have components of influencing, right? And so there's an influence of sort of a social process where you're trying to align folks into a vision, right? A goal where you're trying to direct folks. Management really is aligning organizational goals with individual goals, right? So we can find out what an individual wants and where our organization needs to go, and we just try to align those two things, to match those two things up and make the right decisions. Leadership really is about determining what is right, right? Where are we pushing folks? Is there a vision into the future, and can I get you all to believe in where I'm going on this? And that's a slightly different thing. There's a lot of overlap between the two, of course.
We have an email from a listener who says, I have two sons, both who are working in service sectors. One works as a bartender and one manages a grocery chain. Both come home daily after being exposed to crowds. Why hasn't our government put a mandate in place to close this kind of establishment that are natural places for crowds to gather? Why can't the banks, the economy, just shut down for a determined amount of time and resume business once the crisis passes?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, watching some of those decisions roll out over the past week, right? I mean, the first one I saw was, you know, as they canceled a few parades, you know, no gatherings over 1,000 people. And now we're seeing that get down to 500, and next state goes 250. I've heard 50 recently in New York. And as soon as we get a little bit lower, well, then that's every, you know, restaurant and bar. But for someone to come out so early and say, you know, closing all bars and restaurants, it's a powerful thing unless it comes from really up high. You know, same with Governor Wolf's announcement. you know, I think that really helped as we looked at, you know, in our school district, you know, if a school district nearby us shuts down, then another one does, and I'm sure there's great questioning over should we not, and the governor comes in and just says they're all off right now, right? I don't want to leave that up to each individual person, each individual decision maker or board, and allow a slow rollout of this. We need to make it more urgent.
Another email from Kathy says, I hear that the nation has 6+ depots of emergency supplies that were profiled as having tons of stuff. So does it have the wrong stuff to help in this pandemic, or is it being hoarded for some reason, like being saved for a certain population or a certain density of cases? I don't know whether you can answer that or not, but maybe that is a typical kind of disaster response.
Yeah, and I can't answer that. However, certainly, I think decision makers ought to be planning for a much worse case scenario than we're seeing right now. We might really see this escalate, in which case they might be waiting for a little more triage, to have something to go with in the days and weeks ahead. And so I'm not sure, again, what pulls the trigger on making those decisions and opening up those resources. Certainly a national disaster emergency has helped, but, you know, that's a big question for sure.
Dr. Eric Martin is an associate professor of management at Bucknell University. He studied and written about disaster responses. Dr. Martin, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Be safe.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're focusing on coronavirus today. By the way, coming up on tomorrow's program, at the beginning of tomorrow's program, Pennsylvania's Attorney General Josh Shapiro will be joining us talking about the coronavirus scams and price gouging. Unfortunately, both have happened around the state and around the country as a result of this. But you can go to our website and get an outlook of conversations we're working on. I have to tell you, this is a moving target. Things are changing quickly as we get updates, different guests, different aspects of this. So we'll try to keep that updated as much best we can. But you can get it, get that information by going to WITF.org/smarttalk. Many still have medical questions about COVID-19 or the coronavirus, and social distancing questions as well. Now, here to answer them today is Dr. Jessica Erickson. She's a pediatric infectious disease specialist with Penn State Hershey's Children's Hospital. Dr. Erickson, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Erickson, I want to point out right up front, even though you are an infectious disease, a pediatric infectious disease specialist, I mean, you can comment on all age groups as well, correct?
Oh, certainly, yes.
So I will start with a kid's question. We have been told so far that those most at risk are those who are over the age of 70, older Pennsylvanians, older Americans that maybe have a pre-existing health condition. And I think that's still the case. But I did see a couple reports from Europe in particular, from Italy, over the past couple days that now there are some younger people, that the coronavirus, COVID-19, is showing up in some younger people across Europe. Have you also heard that? And maybe you can talk about it.
So the initial reports coming out of China made it seem like children were not becoming infected, that they weren't getting the virus. As more time has gone on and more information has been collected, we now know that children do become infected. They almost always, much more so than adults, handle the virus very well. So they often don't have any symptoms. Of course, as we start to see, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of people being infected, even a very, very small percentage is going to end up in a few cases, a small percentage of children not doing well, we're going to end up seeing some cases. The real thing that we've learned over the past several weeks is that children do get infected, and even though they may not have any symptoms, they then serve as a way for older adults who end up doing poorly to become infected. So that's really why all the colleges and the school closings have been happening. It's not so much to protect the children, but to keep the children from, you know, becoming carriers to then take the virus home to older adults who are going to end up more severely affected.
It seems as though it has been a bit of a surprise that young children haven't gotten sick. And I guess part of this is because many people compare it to the flu. But usually when we hear about the flu or other illnesses, we're told very young children or older adults. But in this case, it has been only older adults for the most part. Why is that?
I think that's something that we don't entirely understand yet. You know, this is a brand new virus. You know, it's only really been in humans for a few months. So there's a lot that we still don't understand about its biology and how it affects different groups of people. So I think we don't really know yet exactly why children are doing so well. You know, thank goodness they are. That's a question that still remains to be answered.
What about older adults with pre-existing conditions? I mean, it would seem to be common sense that people could figure this out on their own, but I'll ask the specific question. Why are they most at risk?
So their lungs are more fragile is one answer, but the really big thing is that as we age, our immune systems work less well. So their immune systems just aren't able to clear the virus and keep them healthy the way that younger people who have a robust, more efficient immune system is. The immune system is kind of like your body's army against the invading counter army of germs. And if your army is tired, if you don't have as many soldiers, you're less equipped to fight that battle. And that's the main reason why our older friends and neighbors are doing less well.
What about, are there some pre-existing conditions or illnesses that put people more at risk? I mean, this is a respiratory illness. You know, that's one of what sets it apart in a lot of ways from some other illnesses. But someone who has had pneumonia or has had other respiratory illnesses or smokes on a regular basis or did smoke on a regular basis.
Yes, really any lung problem, asthma, COPD, you know, the conditions that you named, those are going to put people at higher risk of having complications. And then also anything similar to old age that makes your immune system work less well. Chemotherapy, you know, chronic steroids, other kinds of medicines that would make your immune system work less well, those are going to be the main things. And then for reasons that we also don't quite understand, maybe it has something to do with the immune system, but even diabetes and high blood pressure, you know, in China and Italy, we've seen that those conditions make people do less well.
Speaking of chemotherapy, and I understand you're willing to talk about this, but you are home today with your own children, but I understand that you are suffering from cancer as well.
Yeah, that's right. I'm 36, so I would not otherwise be in a high-risk group, but I'm unexpectedly finding myself as an infectious disease specialist in the midst of a global pandemic with an immunocompromising condition. So that's kind of an interesting standpoint for me to be looking at things from.
What precautions have you taken?
Well, I've essentially locked myself at home. So I'm going out to my doctor's appointment for chemotherapy, but I've, you know, stocked my fridge with hopefully what will last me a month or so. And I'm, you know, doing my best to really stay away from everyone. So that's something that I'm doing both for myself, but that's the kind of thing that we really need everyone to be doing at this point in terms of social distancing. Even people who aren't at risk for themselves, that staying home and kind of creating a buffer around yourself keeps you from getting the virus, even if you're going to do just fine with it, keeps it you from getting it and then having the opportunity to pass it on, you know, to your grandma or your older colleague who's going to have trouble. So, you know, on one hand, that's something that I'm doing for myself, but that's also something that we need healthy people to be doing for, you know, the sake of the community and you know, our neighbors.
Well, Dr. Harrison, I have to say that our thoughts are with you, and I give you credit for agreeing to be on it with us today, because you have a lot of things on your mind, not only with your job, your own family, but with your own health. So thank you very much for joining us today, and let's hope that I'm just hoping that things work out for you. I have some questions here from listeners. Jan asks, should grandparents over 65 in good health take care of their grandchildren during this time?
So, you know, it really depends on what else those grandchildren are doing. If the grandchildren are really, you know, staying at home with the grandparents and, you know, with their parents who are, you know, being as careful as possible, you know, that doesn't necessarily pose a great risk. If on some of the other days those children are going to daycare, if you're still in a state where schools are open, they're going to school, you know, that would be a higher risk situation. So every family situation is different. You know, some people have to work. Some people, you know, have to go out and do this thing or that thing. But I think that's a question that each family should ask. Is this a wise decision for us to, you know, have our older family members be doing various activities?
Well, childcare has become a big issue where, you know, here in Pennsylvania with schools being closed, that was one of the first questions that and concerns that many people had is, okay, what am I going to do? How am I going to go to work when my kids, I have no one to watch the kids? So that has become a big issue. And we know in very many families, grandparents, we're providing childcare. So from what I'm hearing, you're saying you're going to have each individual family is going to have to make their own decisions on that.
Right. Yeah. And you know, this is a difficult time. You know, these recommendations, we recognize that they're difficult. It's hard to break our routines and to not go to work and to not go to school and to not go to our favorite restaurant and to have our, you know, concert we were looking forward to canceled. But it's not going to get easier. And now is the time that these kind of changes will have the greatest impact on, you know, how things are looking a week from now.
We have a question from another listener. Ask, what's the incubation window, time between possible exposure and when the symptoms start showing?
Yep. So it can be as short as 2 days and as long as 14 days. Most people will have symptoms around day 5. And almost everyone will have symptoms by day 10. So there's a little bit of a tail, but, you know, most people are going to have symptoms between days 5 and 10 after their exposure.
We have another listener who asked, my father falls in the high-risk area, and my mother is a nurse. They live on a sailboat. I'm worried my mother, even with best practices, will bring home this virus to my dad. I've been stressing to them that they need to find another place to hunker down. I've even gone so far as to rent him a home for a few weeks near me. We are so privileged for this to even be an option. I know so many who are not, but they are resistant to this, and I think I'm overreacting. I know we all are struggling with our own accountability and the actions we must take to protect our communities. The question there, I guess, is, and this kind of goes back to everyone has to make their own decisions, but the point that this comes from Tess, that she's making as well, is that the parents are resistant to the change. So what do you do?
Yeah, I would say that I agree with Tess's plan, and applaud her for being so proactive in looking out for her family members. Healthcare workers are working extremely hard to keep themselves and their families and their patients safe. So please do not stigmatize healthcare workers. But the reality is that especially as we start to run out of supplies, like masks, please do not steal them from hospitals and doctors' offices, which has been happening. But it is possible for healthcare workers to bring this virus home to their families. So many of my friends who are actively seeing patients, they're sleeping in different rooms from their spouses, they're not taking care of their children, they're kind of having the non-healthcare parent be the main parent, and the other is kind of a shadow parent to try and keep themselves and their family healthy so that they can continue seeing patients. This is a concern, and yes, it would be best if if the listeners' parents were able to have at least some distance. Good hand washing, wearing masks. It's definitely possible and likely that your mother will not bring the virus home. So, but on the other hand, it's very contagious, so that's also a possibility.
People are actually stealing masks.
Yes, that has been a problem in places where the outbreak has been most significant, Seattle, New York. So there's been a lot of discussion among healthcare workers. Do we need to start locking up our supplies? Like, how do we keep our stockpiles for us? Because I think what a lot of people don't realize is that a lot of the medical supplies are made in China. And with China being so hit so hard, our outbreak here, we are starting out with fewer supplies than typical. And we're going to need more supplies than typical. So hospitals, even before they're seeing any patients with coronavirus, have already started procedures to ration supplies like masks, like surgical gowns. People just being afraid and wanting a box of masks for themselves, that's going to kill healthcare workers in the end. So please don't do that, please.
Hopefully, they won't be stealing toilet paper. Let's take a a call from Bob in Lancaster County. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. So, what's your question?
Good. I'm a retired pharmacist. I gave the questions to the lady that answered the phone. I don't know if she passed them on or not.
She did, but go ahead. You can ask your question. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. As far as I haven't heard the word carrier yet, and I was just wondering if there are such people as carriers of this coronavirus, asymptomatic people that would probably test positive, but they're asymptomatic. Without symptoms, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second one was, as far as testing goes, have they identified false positives or false negatives in testing? I, haven't heard anything about that.
All right, Bob, thank you very much for your call. Dr. Erickson, what about that? First of all, asymptomatic carriers.
Yes. So in part, that has been the problem and why this virus has become so widespread. If we think of the most closely related virus, SARS, the quote-unquote good thing about SARS is that most people became severely ill or died. And what that means from a public health standpoint is they aren't traveling around sharing it with their neighbors. They aren't going to, these public events and infecting a lot of people. In contrast, the COVID-19 virus, 80% of people are asymptomatic or have very mild illness, like a little cold. So they're still, going around where they can then pass on the virus to other people. So, most people are asymptomatic or have mild disease.
We only have about 30 seconds left, and I've gotten a lot of questions. But his second question, I'll ask for a real quick answer. Have there been false positives or negatives in testing?
I would say we haven't done quite enough testing to know exactly what the tests will use in the U.S., what their stats will be around that. There's no 100% perfect test, so I'm sure there will be some of both. But we expect to have a very accurate test, and these kinds of tests are usually very accurate, 99% or so accurate.
Dr. Jessica Erickson is a pediatric infectious disease physician at Penn State's Children's Hospital. Dr. Erickson, thank you very much for being with us, and I hope things go well for you, too.
Yes, thank you very much.
We had a couple good questions, and we will pass these questions along and try to get answers, looking for symptoms in infants and children, and also brushing teeth.